So here we are with Rake the Moon episode 4, and coming up, after being sore from Salford, it's now bruised by Bromley. How did Swindon let it slip against the league leaders? Should we go full Kent Brockman style and crack open each other's heads and feast on the goo within? And January transfer talk. Does it feel more urgent to gallop Finlay Munro style back into the left-back market? Or could it matter more that Saturday's bench didn't contain one out-and-out striker? All on Rake the Moon. So hello, Sam.
Hello, Andrew. How are you? How was Bromley?
Bromley was a strange cultural experience in going to a very progressive club that simultaneously feels like it's a throwback at the same time with the on-pitch style. So ultimately very, very frustrating given the quality of the first half in particular. And furthermore, it is the first time that Ian Holloway has lost a league match after Swindon took the lead since his very first game in charge at MK Dons. And for the banter section, I feel like I should put a TM or copyright there. How do you feel when you hear stats like that? Are you intrigued? Are you curious? Or do you want to slap your head and just wonder at the lack of meaning of it all?
I love stats like that, even if they are completely meaningless within any sort of context. I think it's great when you come up with things that no one else has seen before, and it sparks debate, doesn't it? As much as they can be largely meaningless, they're still entertaining, and part of what we do is meant to be entertaining, I suppose. So, yeah, go ahead. Keep throwing them at me.
I will do my best. I think that's the first one in 27, apparently. Normally when they take the lead, it's a good sign, but not to be. No, I kind of enjoy them. I try not to pepper people with them too much. I just have a bit of a bugbear about the ones that says X team have not beaten Y team at Craven Cottage or wherever since 1978, and they barely played each other. So I think that one annoys me, but most of the time I'll let them go. I mean, if you sort of think of not winning at Cheltenham for a long time, which is now pretty much an everyday occurrence, of course, I think that kind of counted because of context and geography and lots of things, but they don't always.
I know, but they're always good to help embellish a story and to give a little bit more light on something, to add some colour. So I think as long as everybody recognises when a stat has meaning and when it doesn't, then they can be pretty harmless. Just a bit of entertainment.
Yes, we trust you, the listener, to be able to carefully sieve through good and bad stats. Shall we get on with dissecting the last week or so?
Let's do it.
Okay, I guess we should look back at the second part of the Salford double bill. First of all, the non-cup tied, richly rewarded for his move from Fleetwood, Ryan Graydon, instrumental in giving Salford that 3-2 win in the end, and they get the fun of a trip to the Etihad for the second year in a row, which seems a little greedy of them, especially seeming as they don't need the money. And Swindon at Shrewsbury on Valentine's Day, but all three games have obviously had the same scoreline, but it feels like the pattern has been kind of quite similar as well. I think in terms of not only Salford going ahead, but Salford scoring some not well goals. I think Arne Slot would call barely a chance from time to time, like the George Grant one in the first game where he volleys it in from 25 yards and so on. Anyway, what was your sort of take on Salford?
I thought they showed Swindon how to play on their potato patch pitch in that first half. They're a very good team. For me, I think they're the best team in the division that I've seen so far, and I think they were good value for their wins. Probably on all three occasions this season, they've not been runaway, which would suggest that, you know, Swindon have got something about them, but they have been marginally better in all those key areas. And I thought that it probably on reflection was just about fair, maybe. I think that Swindon will still have seen that as a huge chance missed, particularly when they dragged themselves back into it, as they've dragged themselves back into it up there earlier in the season, and to an extent dragged themselves back into it at home the previous game, but they didn't manage to take the chances they did create. And Salford pop up with a very well taken free kick. I think we can get on to sort of Conor Ripley's role in the Bromley winner on Saturday, but that free kick which he came out and put his hands up for, I think he just gets a little bit unlucky by taking that jump to the left as the ball is struck, and so he's slightly off balance from committing the whole way to his right, and he pays a price with an inch perfect free kick. But I thought that Swindon in the second half, at the start of the second half, showed again that if they get the ball down and pass it around a bit, that they can match it and mix it with all the teams at the top of this league. And then again, they kind of stopped doing it. And that's the story of Swindon's season, is we've seen in patches of between 15 and 45 minutes how good they can be. And too often we've then seen them turn the tap off and run really cold for a period. And it's incredibly infuriating as a supporter to watch that, because you know how good you can be. But maintaining that for 90 minutes, I think, has been very limited. There's the Bolton game. I think at Crewe, they were pretty good the whole way through as well, but there's not been many examples. And we can't expect these players at this level to necessarily play to their full potential all the time. But I just think that they will look back on this, and if they don't win promotion this season, one way or another, they will look back at those times where they've been playing well and they've been on top, or they've been clawing their way back into games, and they've just not made it count in the end. And it feels, for whatever reason, a very different situation mindset-wise to how they were in the back end of last year. And if you look then, when they won 11 points and dropped four from the 80th minute onwards in those games between January and May. And since August, they've won 4 points and lost 4 points, I think it is, in those times as well. So it's kind of evened itself out. It's not a massive dip for this year, but compared to last year, the magic of the 80th minute and beyond just isn't happening for them. And it's all conspiring to make things feel perhaps a little bit more negative than if we looked at them objectively they might feel. But it's got to that point, and those games against Salford were the precursor for this. But Swindon weren't awful, they just didn't manage to play at the levels that they can do for long enough.
I wonder if from what Ian Holloway said, especially about the kind of way they passed it in the first half against Bromley, and they didn't, whether they need a recording of Ozzie Ardiles just going play at them just to encourage them to try and keep the ball on the ground or something like that. But the other thing that strikes me from what you said again is whenever you ask the manager about trying to control games, he just looks at you as if that's some kind of alien concept at this level. I think part of that is an indication that there is an opposition who do run around, tackle you, boot you, and hook it forward and do lots of things, but that kind of possession-based domination of a game, I'm not sure he thinks can happen consistently yet he wants them to play.
I think I can sort of understand what he means by the fact that the control is a hard thing to necessarily have when you're playing against another team. He doesn't like that as a concept, and that's fine. But when they do get it down and play, they create chances, and the more chances they create, the more likelihood is that they're going to score, and therefore the further in front of the opposition they can get. And that is an actual tangible concept, which I'm sure that he would accept. What they don't seem to do when they aren't playing quite as intricately, when they're going more direct, either through the channels or looking for Ollie Palmer's forehead or his chest, is they don't have the same creative capacity. They're more stretched through midfield, going long quickly, and they don't seem to have the legs to catch up to the front men in midfield to be able to support them properly, or they're not set up in the way that helps them get supported there. And those creative opportunities don't arise as often. And when those creative opportunities aren't there, that means there's less of a chance of them scoring. So I think that while it's not necessarily total control of the game, it's certainly giving themselves a much better opportunity to be ahead in the game. And that's what we've seen, albeit in catch-up against Salford and in the first half at Bromley, is when they start getting it down, playing it, and they look dangerous. They're good ball players. They're talented footballers that can create plenty in tight spaces and from out wide and down the middle. But for whatever reason, after a period of time, it just stops again and they revert to type. And I don't know whether that's just a confusion as to what the system is and how they should best use Ollie Palmer, although I think we had a great great insight in the first half of how they might be able to use Ollie Palmer at Bromley. But it's just, it feels all a little bit not quite there. It's the players are all there, but the puzzle pieces aren't in the right order, and therefore the picture isn't properly laid out in front of them. And the longer that that goes on, the harder it's going to be for them to pick up the points they need to finish in the top three, which is obviously what their stated aim is from this position. So I think that they've got all of the tools, the right tools to use. They've just got to use them in the right order. And that has been not there for long periods of lots of games.
I would say, and I'm sure someone from Bromley will find this and say how bitter I am. I would say quite confidently that there is no doubt Swindon have better technical players than Bromley do, and they showed that in the first half. But that wasn't enough to kind of move on to that trip and to get that sufficient gap, unfortunately, to kind of go and win the game. Much as you've had those kind of three really good moments for Fletcher Holman, one of which, albeit, does just come from a giant boot down the centre of the pitch that Bromley have a mad kind of 30 seconds in and don't defend. But yeah, that first half, they used sort of Palmer in the withdrawn role behind the two. They were really effective with getting it out sort of down the sides towards Dryden and using his running. And Holman certainly got a bit of that as well. So, you know, that was quite a potent front three, the way it all came together. And yet, as you say, it just stopped, as much to the considerable and quite vulgar bafflement of the manager in one interview, and perhaps to the rest of us.
Yeah, and it was interesting to hear him start to question his team's mentality. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't remember him previously getting quite as direct in questioning his side's mindset, and sort of bringing out the word bottlers is quite a substantial word to use, and obviously there is some evidence for it. But at the same time, he's been one to protect this team and this squad over the last year and a bit, and this felt very much like he felt like they let him down in that particular instance, rather than him setting it out wrong. And I think the first half of that game probably shows that he did set them up pretty well, in that they were pretty incisive and they were creating chances, and Bromley struggled to find a way to combat the midfield and the runners in Drinan and Holman, and they should have been more than one goal in front. And if they are more than one goal in front, the whole game changes complexion. But it's still, you've got to know that your team are going to go out second half from your own kickoff and be able to still be 1-0 up after 45 seconds. And I think them just conceding so quickly just sort of stunned them. It's like it stunned the football out of them, and they just reverted to the channel balls, which really have been largely ineffective for most of the season. And it was just incredibly frustrating. So I can see why he was upset at the end of it. It's just interesting that it's at this point now that he's started to show that. And I imagine that there's probably quite a lot of pressure that's riding on his shoulders at the moment. And it may be beginning to show, or it may just have been that one instance where it was a bad second half and he was frustrated. And I think, you know, in his subsequent interviews as they go on after yours, and obviously you copped a bit from him because you do it so soon after the final whistle, I think as he steadily gets more time between the final whistle and an interview, the interviews steadily get a little bit calmer, and he starts to compute what's happened a little bit better. But it will be interesting to see, if things don't go right at Meadow Lane, whether this pressure is continuing to build and how he reacts to it. And it's going to be a really critical week or so as the transfer window closes and another two league games in a busy period ahead of a long trip to Harrogate on a midweek evening. It's relentless, and there isn't really time to feel sorry for yourself, either as a player or a manager. And Swindon need to not feel sorry for themselves and find a way of bucking this run of negative news items, because the more negative news items that come in succession, the deeper the malaise feels, even if proportionally it's not that much of a malaise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's interesting, the degree of malaise, as it were, because I think if you look at it feels like if you look at social media for any club, that there's a certain kind of catastrophization, shall we say, and no one's going to say this is a good week, especially with, you know, three defeats in a row, which is something Ian Holloway is certainly not used to at Swindon. But you add the kind of Luton thing on top of it, and no wonder he's feeling a bit on the fraught life. I wouldn't make too much of people copying it in interviews. I think that happened. I wouldn't say that happens often, but it's a semi-normal part of journalist-manager relations, I think, especially when they've just lost in a way that's particularly infuriated him, and he's midway through a sequence of four different interviews with Sky and ITV there as well. And I would imagine getting asked, why such a difference between the first and second half four times, which is the inevitable obvious question, gets a bit wary.
Yeah, I agree. I think at some point, maybe when we're outside of a transfer window and we've not got so much going on the field, that it'll be interesting to examine the art of the Ian Holloway interview as a subject and hear a little bit more from you as to how you go about it and what to expect and what's normal and what's not so normal and sort of the game that's played between an interviewer and an interviewee in those moments, both before and after games. I think we should definitely talk about that in the future.
And I'm sure that will come up. It's a slightly odd relationship because we are probably the most diametrically opposite people in terms of general kind of bounce and energy that humanity could throw together. But we sort of get on all right, really. People have to take my word for that. You did threaten to touch on Conor Ripley, as we must. I think he was, you know, he put a statement on social media about that free kick for Salford and said, you know, I could have done better with it. Although it didn't appear the most criminal mistake in the world. But, you know, clearly he is caught underneath the ball for the Bromley winner. You know, there's no question of a foul there in anyone's mind. The players don't really appeal for it. You can certainly point to lots of collective defensive mistakes in the build-up to the cross coming in, but the goalkeeper, inevitably part of the job, is that they always look more culpable as the last line of defence.
Yeah, it was an odd one, wasn't it? Because he didn't seem to really get off the ground at all. And he had been largely managing to get a fist to the ball for most of the rest of the game. So I'm pretty sure that behind closed doors he will be... Well, first of all, he'd be very frustrated with his defence that cross was able to get in there in the first place, and that there wasn't really a defender challenging in the air when it came. But I'm pretty sure he'll look back and go, I could have done a lot better with that. What's really important here, I think, is contextualising his performances over the course of the season, because he's got a lot of stick at times. And I think largely, though obviously Saturday is different, but largely I think it's been a bit unfair. And because that opinion, that perception of his performances at times is there from earlier in the season. When there is a mistake like the one at Bromley, it's only going to go to exacerbate people's opinions of the guy. And actually, I think if you look objectively at his performances, he's actually been an incredible improvement on what Swindon have had at the back for a long period of time. So he was at fault there, but he has a net positive contribution to this team.
Yeah, no, I feel the overall Ripley account is kind of very much in credit when you think of, well, three goals conceded in the nine games before. I mean, there are a couple of terrific stops just against, you know, Gillingham, for example, that secure the points, and I think against Crawley as well. I didn't think his shot stopping really to me is of great concern, by and large. So no, I would imagine that, you know, there will be frustrations at a week that has not gone as well as it was, but we seem to be aligned in the net amount of credit in the bank anyway. So to kind of summarise, Sam, in Kent Brockman style, I suspect you do not wish to crack open various heads and feast on the goo within. How calm are you at this point, despite, you know, everyone feeling that the pressure a bit?
I think, like any Swindon supporter, you worry, don't you, about the hope slipping away and the promise of what could be disappearing, because we don't get that promise very often at this part of the world. or at least we haven't for a while. So there is always the knee-jerk fear, the sort of sense of inevitable doom that comes with being a Swindon Town fan. And it's hard to balance that out with the reality of what's going on the pitch and off the pitch. The games that they've lost have all been by a single goal to teams in the top, well, who are the top two currently. I think Salford, as I've said, are the best team in the division. Bromley will do fantastically well to stay in the top three, but are obviously incredibly well drilled and have been on a remarkable run. So there is the context of the opposition, the timing of the games against this opposition, and the fact they've been missing their captain, who would have made a significant difference in the middle of midfield, the fact that they have come back into games, and the fact that they have scored goals in these games and looked threatening, is all mitigating evidence against the idea that this is some sort of crisis. And I don't think it's a crisis yet. I think they need to get through this week and get out of this transfer window, because I can imagine that for Ian Holloway, this is quite a lot all at once. Because the club's ownership and executive management rarely put themselves out voluntarily to address anybody about anything, unless you push them relatively hard, it means that he's the public face of the club in almost every way, even though he quite sternly told your colleague Sean that he wasn't fond of that, I think, the other week. But that will come with its own pressures, because this is a guy who's currently trying to manage a squad. He's trying to coach a squad. He's trying to build a squad with all the recruitment that comes with it. And he's also having to field questions around administrative stuff, FA charges, EFL charges. I'm sure that if we could, we'd ask him about anything, because we don't often get answers from further up. So he's being asked to be a spokesperson, a manager, a coach, a director of football, a secretary, a therapist, and a friend to everyone within that club to manage them through a difficult period. And that's going to be difficult, and it's going to weigh quite heavily. So get through the transfer window and hopefully get through at least a chunk more of these relentless onslaught of games with a few points and a little bit more positivity to think about. And then maybe there's the light relief that allows him to pass on more freedom to his players and for them to not feel quite as stressed. Because if he as an emotional man is imparting stress into that dressing room, not deliberately, but just because he's emotional, then that may feed into some negativity too. And I think it's really important that we just get through this window. Hopefully he'll bring in the player or players that he wants to help bolster the squad, and then they can refocus back on being a football team. But I think that he could certainly do with some support from above at this point, not in terms of money, because obviously he's being given what he wants to get the players that he wants to the level that the club can afford without equity investment. But I think he could just do with the chief executive and the chairman just going out and saying some things and, you know, doing some interviews, do some PR, do some press, just try and take some of the non-football weight off of their manager, and try and create narratives that don't involve him so that he can get on and do his core job as best he can. Ultimately, this is very unlikely to happen, but if I was in charge, that's how I would be trying to help him alleviate that strain over the course of the next week. But there's a week left, or by the time this gets published, less than a week left of the transfer window. And that's not too long to wait, two games. Let's get into February. And we all know that teams that put together runs in February and March generally are the ones that are going to go up.
Well, the chairman is here, so let's see what happens. So as is compulsory for these episodes of Rake the Moon, we must open the transfer window and let its beauteous light cast upon us. There are two positions we mentioned kind of at the top there, and one where you have gently thrown a name into the waters for Moonraker subscribers, in that of Jake Batty, the Blackburn left back, who was on loan at Accrington last season. I can remember from the two visits to Accrington, very well thought of there in his time there. And well, I do a bit of opinionising here. You might well go at Tony Accrington, but the defence is probably the strength of their side, really. So we didn't see Billy Kirkman on Saturday either. He didn't have a great time up at Salford. So is your sense the balance is swinging towards finding some external help in that left-back position?
Yeah, it is. I don't have no idea whether actually Jake Batty will remain on that list. He's one that has been spoken about in the recent past, and they have a target list, but I'm not certain who currently tops that target list. By the sounds of it, they haven't actually sort of gone for it yet, but I'm fully expecting that they go for a left wing back, probably a slightly more attacking option left wing back, because they do have defensive options for a full back if they want to just play with a four. I think the issue they've got here is you're not going to find someone who replaces Finlay Munro at short notice in January. It's just not going to happen. So they have to find someone who has the attacking attributes, or at least his delivery, even if not the slide tackling and the willingness to run back and make those tackles. So there'll be options. They've got to decide whether they want to go for a similar profile in a loan, or if they want to try and find a more senior position. Sorry, a more senior defender for the position. My instinct is they still would use that loan slot for him. But it does feel an awful ask to try and find someone. And I think that there is always the possibility that if he's going to swap to a 4-3-3 or a 4-3-1-2 or whatever you want to call it on a regular basis, do you need, having already brought in Michael Olakigbe, do you need another wide player who could play down on that side? It's interesting. I think they will sign a left-sided wing back slash fullback, and I think that will probably be the most prominent position that they would want to fill, but it's very hard to get the right man in January, let alone the right man when you've only got a few days left of the window and they're traveling to Harrogate on deadline day, which kind of makes things that little bit more awkward as well.
Yeah, of course, a rearranged game on the Tuesday night means Monday night travel, because it's a heck of a long way. Harrogate, and the window does shut on the Monday evening. And I believe there's quite a useful BBC Southwest transfer programme coming again, as there was in August, to satisfy some of my other multiple employers there. Keep them
going. Absolutely. Whenever you have the chance, Colin, whenever you have the chance, you must plug them.
Yes. Lastly, I did note at the start again that there wasn't an out-and-out striker on the bench, and I have tried to start a self-imposed ban on the S and R phrase, but that struck me as unusual. And with Billy Bowden still out for a few weeks, we think, I'm not sure I'd completely rule out some other forward being magically rustled up from somewhere. But the type they want, are they happy to come with not necessarily a guarantee of regular minutes? Would make that quite a hard challenge, I think, to do that and maintain the quality they've got, unless they have more Fletcher Holmans up their sleeve.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, so far that's proven to be a very useful signing, hasn't he? He started really nicely. I think the question that we have to ask around this is, if there's already a bit of a struggle to fit Ollie Palmer into this team, if you bring in a more senior forward, a goal-scoring forward, into a team that's already got the division's top goal scorer in it and a player that they're having to find a way to accommodate because he was a prominent signing, what benefit do you have? Someone is going to have to be the player that plays 30 minutes. And is that going to then end up having a net benefit on the dressing room environment by bringing someone in who was expecting to play more, or who you have to leave someone else out because you need to play them more? And whether or not that's actually what you need, you know, Swindon have been scoring goals this year, just the calendar year so far. You know, they've been creating chances. They haven't all been taken, but there's still plenty of creativity there. To me, it's less of a need for a striker and more of a need for finding the order in which those forward parts are put together to create the chances. And while they didn't have an out-and-out striker on the bench, in theory, they had three up front to start the game, and all three have scored this year, I think. And they're all capable of playing in different roles up front. And then you've got obviously the likes of Olukigbe and Snowden and Oldacre to support them. Butterworth, whenever he gets back fit, Billy Bowden too. I know he likes to stack them and rack them, but there must be some point where you stack them and rack them too much that you can no longer balance the pile and it all falls down.
I wonder whether we should perhaps dig into the kind of forward line in a bit more depth in a future episode, because it is, I think it is perhaps the most intriguing part of how the team is glued together. But I've just raised another topic for us to do, and we are pretty much well into our allocation of time for episode 4 of Rake the Moon. Thank you very much for listening. A reminder, of course, you can subscribe to the Moonraker for Sam Swindon Town coverage and those juicy transfer nuggets that he's annoyingly good at getting, I must say. So I hope you've enjoyed what we've come up with, and we will muse on the same time next week when the window is almost done.